All suspects are considered innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. Tallahassee, Florida, normally a quiet rural suburb, but when a university professor is left bleeding uncontrollably on his driveway, that would all change. The man's name, Dan Merkel, a seemingly popular man with two young sons and everything to live for. Police are left with no clues, no suspects, no DNA, and only one vague witness. This case would not be solved quickly or easily. The police would need to use all of their experience and patience to get to the bottom of it. Welcome to the Beyond Evil podcast, where we discuss and dissect the most mysterious, terrifying, and mind-bending cases from all over the world. Before we start, we would like to send our sincere condolences to the family and friends of Dan Merkel, who was taken cruelly from this world in the prime of his life. Born in 1972 in Toronto, Canada, Dan Merkel was a successful and very intelligent man. Throughout his education, Dan attended various universities, including the University of Jerusalem, Cambridge, and finally Harvard, where he achieved his law degree in 2001. For the next few years, Dan worked at a law firm as a clerk, but in 2005, an opportunity arose that he couldn't turn down. Florida State University was looking for someone with Dan's exact qualifications to work in their College of Law, and he jumped at the chance. Dan couldn't have been any better suited for his new career at the university. Firstly, he loved teaching other people, and secondly, he loved criminal law. While teaching various law classes at the university, Dan also found time to write many papers on criminal law as well. Another welcome addition to Dan's life was his new partner, Wendy Adelson, who he had met on a dating site for Jewish singles. Dan was 33 years old at this point. Wendy was 26. They were perfectly suited, as Wendy also enjoyed law, which she was studying when the pair met, and later, just like Dan, she would go on to teach law at the Florida State University. The relationship got off to a flying start, so much so that the couple couldn't wait to be married. Within a short period, they had met, gotten to know each other, gotten engaged, and finally got married on the 26th of February 2006. Dan and Wendy were living their perfect lives, both had their dream jobs, good incomes, and in 2009 they had their first son, followed closely by a second son in 2010. Life seemed great. That is, until 2012, when their relationship hit the rocks and the couple separated. Prior to the divorce, the couple really kept the details between themselves. Nobody can be certain as to why the marriage took a dive so dramatically. As you probably gathered, neither Dan nor Wendy were the kinds of people who let the grass grow under their feet. Continuing this trend of not hanging around, they were divorced by 2013. Whatever image they presented to the world, it did not reflect the life at home. Dan had been away on a work trip. As he walked through his front door, he was stunned. Not only for there being no signs of his wife or children, but the house had been stripped almost entirely bare. Wendy had left a few items behind for Dan, including a mattress. This took some organizing. You know yourselves, moving a house can be stressful and does take planning. Wendy had not just decided to leave Dan overnight. She had clearly been thinking about this for a long time. The lengths she had gone to in stripping their home demonstrates just how south the marriage had gone. There was also one other item that Wendy left for Dan on top of the mattress, a stack of divorce papers. The divorce was anything but straightforward. Wendy had clearly an axe to grind, and grind it she would, seemingly doing anything she could do to hurt Dan throughout the process. Dan described their divorce as a Pearl Harbor-style separation. Quite a statement. Wendy changed the children's surnames to her own and even changed one of the middle names because it had been given as a tribute to one of Dan's dead relatives. Wendy was conducting the separation with a scorched earth mentality. She was trying her best to wipe any trace of Dan Merkel from her and the children's lives. It's one thing for a man and a woman to realize they no longer want to be together, but in a case involving children, surely they would still have to co-parent. Trying to detach the children from their father, or from any parent, seems vindictive and callous. Let's fast forward a little bit to 2014. Dan and Wendy were getting on with their separate lives, both, of course, having access to their sons. Wendy had taken up writing. She wrote a law book focusing on people trafficking, but she didn't seem to have the same way with words that Dan did, and the whole thing was a massive flop. The book was described as criminally lousy, so people had no need to rush to their local bookstore. July 18th, Dan makes his way over to Wendy's house to pick up the children and to take them to preschool. It was pretty typical of his routine. He also went to the gym, visited a few shops, nothing really out of the ordinary, but that would soon change. By 11 a.m., he had finished his errands and had returned home. Just as he pulled up into his driveway, he noticed someone was already there waiting for him. It was not made public who Dan was on the phone with at the time, but this person did tell police about their conversation. Whoever the person was that had been waiting for Dan was waiting to ambush him, and they weren't messing around. There was no conversation between them at all, just a loud bang. Before Dan even had time to open his car door, a bullet was fired through the driver's side window, hitting Dan in the middle of his face with a velocity so great that his head collided with the headrest. A neighbor overheard the shot and saw the bloody scene firsthand. Dan still sat upright in the driver's seat, smashed glass everywhere, the car's interior and windshield covered in blood. The neighbor immediately called 911. The neighbor said, "I saw a car pull into the driveway. Then there was a gunshot. My neighbor is sat in the front of the car in a bad way. He's still alive, but can't respond to me. You need to send an ambulance quickly. We don't know if he's tried to kill himself or if someone shot him, but he needs help." As the ambulance was dispatched, police tried to extract any information they could from the neighbor, but the only thing he saw was a silver Toyota Prius leaving the area straight after the gunshot. This was something for police to go on, at least, but it could have been nothing. It could have just been someone driving by on their normal routine on any normal day. The ambulance arrived 19 minutes later, and Dan was rushed to the nearest hospital. Unfortunately, there had been a mistake. The dispatcher, who had spoken to Dan's neighbor, failed to tell the ambulance just how serious the condition was, which is why it took it 19 minutes to arrive. The man had a gunshot wound through his face. Every single second was vital if he had any chance of survival. We will never fully know if the ambulance's late arrival contributed, but Dan did not survive his injuries. He died in intensive care 14 hours later. The police now had a difficult task on their hand. A man with seemingly no enemies, well-liked, a family man, had been shot and killed in cold blood in his driveway. And all they had to go on was the sighting of a silver Toyota Prius, which may or may not have had any involvement. A memorial was held for Dan a short time later, which really highlights what people thought of him. The service was very well attended, with friends, family, and students alike all eager to pay their last respects. With no evidence or suspects, the police had one place to start: Dan's ex-wife, Wendy Adelson. Wendy was brought in by police on the same day that Dan was shot. Wendy was not under arrest, but police had to start somewhere. As she enters the interview room, she listens to a voicemail left by a friend who was an estate agent. The voicemail said, "Hi, Wendy. I feel a bit silly doing this. I'm not trying to be dramatic, but there was a shooting around where you used to live today. I hope you're okay, my friend." Wendy, visibly shaken, played the voicemail for the police investigators. The investigators told her what was going on. "I'm sorry you had to hear it that way, but there was a shooting at your former home today. Your ex-husband has been very seriously injured and is likely not going to survive." Wendy was very emotional and instantly burst into tears. She says that she messaged Dan that morning and everything was fine. She then asks the investigators what happened to her ex-husband. The officer tells her that he cannot give her any information until he has established her whereabouts at the time of the shooting to rule her out of any inquiries. Wendy is very cooperative, but also almost inconsolable with grief. Wendy tells the officer she didn't leave her home until around noon. I left the house to go do a few jobs. I even tried to drive up my old street, but noticed it was blocked. Oh my God. When she was asked if she knew anyone who might have a reason to harm Dan, she just continued to cry uncontrollably, eventually responding, "He used to rub people the wrong way sometimes, but I don't think there's anybody who would want to do this to him." The investigator asks if Dan owed any money to anybody, to which she said through crying eyes, "No, well, he owes me money." The investigator pounces and says, "So he owes money to you?" Wendy just replied, "It wasn't me." Wendy came across as genuinely shocked, and she was distraught, and the interviewing officer handled her very carefully and compassionately. The problem for the police was that they still had nothing else to go on. Police felt that it couldn't have been a robbery because the person didn't attempt to enter Dan's home, nor did they reach into his car or go through his pockets to steal his wallet, house keys, or credit cards. There was only one motive they could go on at this time: revenge. But revenge for what? Was Wendy right? Had Dan rubbed somebody the wrong way? The problem is, annoying is one thing, but to annoy someone to the point where they would get a gun and shoot you in cold blood in broad daylight is quite another. In an attempt to generate leads, police decided to appeal to the public. They made it clear that Dan Merkel was the intended victim of a crime. It was premeditated and not a random act of violence. A reward was immediately offered to anyone that could come forward with information that led to an arrest and conviction. The reward started out at $1,000 but kept rising until it hit $25,000. An anonymous donor also offered a $100,000 reward on top of the police reward. The police widened their net of potential suspects. They questioned students, friends, and family. But despite their best efforts, it all came to nothing. Everyone kept saying the same thing. Dan was a really nice guy, a good teacher, good father, and son. No one seemed to have any idea why someone would want to kill him. In any murder investigation, the first 24 hours are absolutely crucial for gathering evidence, but the police had surpassed this quite some time ago. 12 months went by, and they still had nothing new to go on. A fresh press conference was held on the one-year anniversary of the murder. This is when, for some strange reason, the police first released images of the silver Toyota Prius. Police had never explained why they waited a year to divulge that information. After all, in 12 months, the car could have been torched or scrapped. Who knows? The fresh appeal, once again, got them nowhere. The trail had gone cold. The case remained open for a further 12 months with no movement. Whoever had committed the murder had now more than ample time to dispose of any evidence, and the chances of the police solving the case were slim to none. That is, until May the 26th of 2016, nearly 2 years since Dan had been killed. A Leon County judge issued a warrant for Sigfredo Garcia, age 34. The warrant is for first-degree murder. The murder of Dan Merkel, to be more precise. Tallahassee police had refused to give any details at the time of the arrest, presumably to avoid damaging their case. But a few days later, the Leon County judge ordered that a probable cause affidavit be unsealed and made public. It revealed that investigators believed Garcia had an accomplice, Luis Rivera, age 33, that the pair had traveled from Miami in a rented, silver Toyota Prius, moving between motels on the 16th and 17th of July. The police had gathered various bits of other information on the pair. They had the cell phone data, electronic toll collection records, and security camera footage from different buildings and buses from all around the area. The footage, they believed, showed the pair shadowing Dan Merkel on the 18th of July as he went about his daily business, from the preschool to the gym and around to the shops and then home. They also managed to check all vehicle records for the Prius going back to the murder. But why are these two men suspects all of a sudden? And why should they choose to kill a man they seemingly had never even met before? The police strongly suspected that this was a murder-for-hire case. Garcia and Rivera had been paid to kill Dan Merkel. Most mysterious of all, their information came from an informant who has since remained anonymous. That leaves one very important unanswered question. If this was a murder-for-hire case, who did the hiring? All was about to be revealed. Whatever Garcia and Rivera were paid for their services, it was not enough for them to take all the blame. They quickly started to sing like canaries during their police interviews once they realized the game was up. They revealed to police that they had been hired by none other than Charlie and Donna Adelson. Charlie was the brother of Dan's ex-wife, and Donna was her mother. Both of them, on the face of it, respectable people who ran the Adelson's Institute, a dentistry practice. Charlie was the dentist, and Donna was in charge of managing the patients. You might not believe it, but this information on its own was not enough to implicate Charlie and Donna. For all the police knew, their murder suspects could be naming anyone in a desperate attempt to save their own necks. What possible connection could there be between a respected family man who ran a dental practice and two hitmen from Miami? Surprisingly, it didn't take too long to find out. As it turned out, the missing link was a woman named Catherine Magbanua. Not only was she in a relationship with Charlie Adelson, but in a previous life, she had been in a relationship with Sigfredo Garcia and had two children with him. Phone data showed that Catherine received a phone call from Luis Rivera almost straight away after the shooting of Dan Merkel, presumably to tell her the job had been done. Catherine had been the sole go-between. Rivera, Garcia, and the Adelsons said they never met each other before. Catherine was paid $100,000 to organize everything. Catherine's bank account showed that over a 12-month period, she had been making deposits worth tens of thousands of dollars. This started months before Dan Merkel was killed and continued for months afterward as well. Somewhat stupidly, the payments were nearly always in the form of a check, not the smartest move by the Adelsons. Checks are very easy to trace for one simple reason. They have to be signed by somebody. Each and every check deposited was signed by Donna Adelson. Hate is a strong word, but in this case, it might seem proper to use it. Donna Adelson hated her ex-son-in-law. In the 15 months leading up to the murder, she had sent email after email to Wendy, calling Dan every name under the sun. We'll leave it to your imagination, but suffice it to say that she used every profanity known when describing him. One email read, "You suffered under him long enough when you were married. His narcissism ruined your marriage. Let's hit him where it hurts. You know his weak points." The Adelson family themselves lived in Miami, but of course Wendy didn't. She lived near Dan in Tallahassee. However, she did want to move to Miami to be closer to her family, but Dan would not allow it. He didn't do anything violent, such as threaten her or anything like that. He went through the courts and got an order that prohibited Wendy from moving away with the children. This was because, in their divorce settlement, they had agreed to 50-50 custody. One reason his mother-in-law may have disliked him so much, however, is that Dan went to the courts shortly before his murder and filed a motion that would have stopped Donna Adelson from being allowed to spend time with their children alone and unsupervised. His justification for all of this was the abuse he said he was receiving from her as well. This, of course, did not justify in any way Donna's actions. As we know, the murder had been planned long before the motion was filed in the courts. So far, this all seems pretty straightforward, right? Angry mother-in-law, daughter's ex-husband, grudge gone too far. But don't believe it. Luis Rivera was about to blow the whole case wide open. Luis, while serving time without bail due to unrelated charges, asked to speak to the investigators. He said he had information to exchange for a deal. Investigators were open to the offer and agreed to re-interview him. Luis told the investigators his version of the events. He claimed that he was not aware that anyone would be killed until he had already gotten in the car with Garcia. He says that he was told it was a simple drug robbery. When he was told about killing Dan Merkel, he says he was not happy about it and just suggested robbing the woman who was going to pay them to do it. He and Garcia were to be paid $35,000 each. But still, Rivera said that he didn't want to kill a man who had two children he had never met and had nothing against. He claims he had never even heard the name before and didn't know what he looked like until Garcia showed him a picture. He did maintain that he had never heard of the Adelsons, but he did refer to a woman called Katie. Katie, of course, being short for Catherine. He claimed that she was the main woman behind it all. Rivera said that the reason for them being given the contract in the first place was because a woman wanted her children back. She wanted full custody. Up to this point, the Adelsons were still denying any involvement in the murder. Despite the police having checks signed by Donna, it actually doesn't prove that she wanted Dan murdered. Those checks could have been written for any number of reasons. At this point, the FBI got involved. They came up with a sting operation to try to catch the family. Charlie Adelson started receiving strange phone calls from a cell phone. These phone calls were made from a man who called himself Sandy. Sandy asked why Rivera was not being taken care of inside of prison and why his family wasn't being taken care of on the outside. The caller claimed that everyone else involved was being looked after and he wasn't happy about it. Charlie was clearly intimidated by the phone calls, but also managed to keep his cool long enough not to incriminate himself. Lucky for him, because Sandy, of course, was an undercover cop. The FBI had hacked Charlie's cell phone in an attempt to hear something they could pin on him, but for now, the attempt had failed. In July of 2016, a grand jury in Leon County indicted Garcia and Rivera on charges of first-degree murder. Catherine was also arrested just a short time later as well. Rivera, who, as we already know, was serving time for other offenses, managed to get his charge downgraded to second-degree murder, presumably for his cooperation and a guilty plea. He had been sentenced to 12 years for the unrelated offenses and was to be given 19 additional years for his part in the Dan Merkel murder. The trials of Catherine and Sigfredo were merged and took place on October 19th, as they both faced the same charges. The defense claimed that Charlie Adelson had instigated the whole sordid affair. He had allegedly promised $100,000 to be split between the three for the murder so that his sister could gain full custody of her children without Dan interfering any longer. During the trial, the prosecutors summoned an interesting witness, a man by the name of Jeffrey Lacasse, who just happened to be the ex-boyfriend of Wendy Adelson. He confirmed that he had heard from Wendy that her brother, Charlie, had discussed hiring a hitman to kill Dan on several occasions. Jeffrey said, "On July 13th, Wendy asked me if she could share something with me confidentially. I said yes. She said that Charlie had explored all options with regards to her problem and that he was talking about getting a hitman to kill Professor Merkel. She told me it would cost around $50,000. Sigfredo Garcia claimed in his defense that the fatal shot was fired by his accomplice, Luis Rivera. The problem was, Rivera had always claimed that it was, of course, the other way around. Nevertheless, it was hardly good enough to get him off of the charge of first-degree murder. He was found guilty and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, plus an additional 30 years for conspiracy. He indicated that he would appeal the sentence. As for Catherine, or Katie, as she was sometimes known, she denied any involvement in the murder whatsoever. At the same trial as Garcia, her charges were downgraded to second-degree murder, but the jury was unable to come to a decision. The judge declared it a mistrial. She would have to appear in court again. Catherine's retrial began on the 16th of May, 2022, and lasted 11 days. This time, the jury was more convinced. On the 27th of May, she was convicted of first-degree murder and solicitation to commit murder. She was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for the first-degree murder and a further 30 years for the solicitation and another 30 years for conspiracy. With what is believed to be the three main culprits behind bars, surely this case was closed. Not quite. Just when things began to settle down, a fresh arrest was made. Police turned up to the address of Charlie Adelson on the 21st of April, 2022. He was arrested and charged with first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and solicitation to commit murder. In a shock discovery, police acquired audio recordings between Catherine and Charlie, both of them discussing the plot to kill Dan Merkel. He is set to go on trial in April of 2023. As this case draws to a close, one can't help but think there are still many questions left unanswered. For a start, how much did Wendy really know? Going off of testimonies, it seems that Rivera, Garcia, and Magmanua all understood why Dan Merkel was to be killed to ensure Wendy had full custody of her children. Tie that in with Wendy's conversation with Jeffrey Lacasse, and it isn't difficult to come to the conclusion that she could have been more involved than she let on. Although we must stress there is no evidence to support this, and she has not been indicted on any charges. Donna Adelson, she's the one who signed all of the various checks worth thousands of dollars, it was proven beyond all reasonable doubt that she despised her former son-in-law and wanted to make his life as miserable as possible. Again, what was the extent of her involvement? Did she just sign the checks, or was she involved in any of the planning? Just like her daughter, there is no compelling evidence against her, and she has not been indicted. So far, two people have been given life sentences, another has been given a lengthy spell behind bars, but any suggestion that these three acted alone simply just doesn't hold up. At least two of them had never met Dan Merkel before, and if Catherine had ever met him, Wendy and he would have long since separated, so she couldn't have held any grudge against either of them. It was all down to Charlie Adelson. He is, of course, the only member of the family who will go on trial in April, so far, at least. Perhaps when faced with a life sentence, Charlie may give up a few more details. As this case developed, more and more people were implicated in this web of criminality. But as always at Beyond Evil, our focus and sympathies are always for the victim. Dan Merkel, as far as we can see, had no enemies. He never hurt anyone. Despite his former mother-in-law's accusations, he certainly did not deserve to die. Friends and family, colleagues, all have spoken highly of the legacy he has left behind. His extensive papers that he wrote on various law subjects, the thousands of students whose lives he improved and influenced by teaching them so well. Most importantly of all, his two sons, who he adored, have lost their father. Dan lived for his children, which explains why he went to court so often to ensure they could not be taken away from him. Without a doubt, Dan had more to offer this world had he been given the chance. But tragically, at just 41 years old, his life was cut short by two men he never met, who were hired by a woman he had never met. Rest in peace, Dan Merkel. If you found this story compelling, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen, and please leave a 5-star review if you would like to show your support. Also, share the podcast through your social media. Also, don't forget to hit the notification bell in order to stay up to date each time we reveal a new shocking case. Until next time, stay safe and keep your eyes peeled. You never know what's lurking in the shadows.